and thank you for listening to the History of World War II podcast, episode 209, Dark Days for Chiang Kai-shek. The Battle of Shanghai, which had been going on since August 13, 1937, had become a war of attrition, as Chiang Kai-shek refused to abandon the city, while General Matsui, commander of the Japanese Expeditionary Force, was obsessed with teaching the upstart and inferior Chinese who was the greater race. The Japanese had superior weapons, the Chinese defenders, more men. But from August to the 1st of October, the invaders had been able to push out from the coast, just north of the great city, while the defenders continued to backpedal in order to maintain cohesion. But now that Matsui had his reinforcements from the homeland and Taiwan, it was time to push south from Lodian and take Shanghai proper. The offensive commenced on October 1st with the, from west to east, Japanese 9th, 3rd, and 101st Divisions. Their goal was the Suzhou Creek, which, if reached, would bring the attackers just west of Shanghai. As for the defenders still within the city, they would then be cut off from help by the Nationalist Army and forced to retreat south in order not to be captured. Just 3 miles or 1.8 kilometers south of Lodian, the town of Liaohong was the Japanese first victim. The town could not be held, so Chiang wisely decided to abandon it to maintain a solid defensive line. The defenders moved back to the Wuson River, another 3 miles to the south. Here, another defensive line was formed. But the Japanese, with their superior guns and air power, pushed the defenders back. Parts of the three Japanese divisions crossed the Wuson and stayed hard upon the heels of the reeling Chinese. By October 11th, Chiang Kai-shek's frustration was boiling over. The enemy, it seemed, could not be stopped, and it looked like the beginning of the end of Shanghai, China's largest city and the sixth largest city in the world. This could not be allowed to happen. The leader called a meeting that day, and it was decided that another defensive line would be constructed, this one at the town of Dachang, 3 miles south of the Wuson River, about halfway between the Wuson and the Suzhou Creek, Matsui's main goal. And as this new line stretched to the west, just past the road that came down from Lodian, that flank would be covered as well. All of this was well and good, but if this line couldn't hold, like the others, then how were the invaders to be pushed back? But that's when General Bai Chongzi, an informal advisor from the south, suggested that four divisions be used to hit on either side of the Wuson River. Not only could a new defensive line then be re-established there, but the Japanese divisions further south would be cut off from reinforcements and supplies. It would be turning the tables on the invaders. As for where these men were supposed to come from, Bai Chongzi also had the answer. Currently en route were four divisions from South China's Guangxi province. They would be here soon and could be split into two groups of two divisions. Then each group would take a bank of the Wuson and drive east, sweeping the enemy before them. Chiang's German advisors were not enthusiastic about this, but the leader approved the plan anyway, probably out of desperation. The area between Wuson Creek and Dachang became a replica of the bloody fields of France during the Great War. Though some Chinese units kept at bay the enemy units before them, others managed to cross the Wuson and were attempting to push further south. The Japanese would use their artillery and air power to dominate a section of the enemy line before them, killing thousands, only to have fresh Chinese troops rush into the gap at the last minute. So when the Japanese came charging at the supposed weakened spot, they would soon retreat, having suffered immense casualties themselves. This loop played out for 4 days in the middle of October. Then the rains came, which sent General Matsui into a funk. Rain slowed everything down, from the arrival of supplies to his men's advances. Then he got word that several Chinese warlords and generals were moving their headquarters closer to the front. If that were so, then his hope of pushing them away was obviously not working. And if all these commanders were bringing men with them, that would explain why his better armed men were not able to reach Dachang. No, now was not the time for a major push, as his men were clearly outnumbered. But Matsui was not a quitter, nor would he allow his men to be so. While the rains poured down, the Japanese focused on trudging their guns up to the front and digging their trenches closer to the enemy lines. That way, if there was another big push, then his men would have less ground to run across before getting at the enemy. But another reason to be downhearted was that the weather was getting colder, and his men were still in their summer uniforms. Soon, winter clothes would come for the 3rd and 11th Divisions, and they desperately needed that good news. By now, some 6,000 men of the lucky 3rd were now casualties of one sort or another. But the news for Matsui was about to get much worse. On October 19th, word was sent to the Japanese general that several divisions from the Guangxi province further south had just arrived in the Shanghai area, and they seemed to be deploying near the Wusong Creek. Now, for the last week or so, other reinforcements had come, but all of them were sent directly into the fighting, which is what kept Matsui's men away from Dachang. It made the general nervous that these four divisions were sent elsewhere. Clearly, a fight that de-evolved into a slugfest benefited the more numerous Chinese, so Matsui devised a plan outside of the box. Ordering a fleet of 8 destroyers and about 20 transport ships to sail up the Yangtze River, far past Chuangshaku, their most northern possession, Matsui was hoping that Chang would pull men from Dachang and send them north. However, the nationalist leader did not fall for this ploy. So then Matsui raised the stakes by having the flotilla shell various locations as if readying for a landing. But again, Chang let the areas to the north suffer. His priority, rightly so, was protecting Shanghai. China's request to have this invasion brought before the League of Nations was about to get underway. For most foreigners, the only Chinese city they knew was Shanghai. If the fight continued somewhere else, then the Westerners would probably not care as much, as it would be over an unknown entity that they probably couldn't find on a map. By the third week of October, the fighting positions of both sides had settled somewhat between Wusong Creek and Dachang. Occasionally, a Japanese officer would yell, "Charge!" and his men, so conditioned, would instantly rise up and head for the Chinese line some 150 yards away. Not that they made it, as the Chinese machine guns mowed them down. The surviving attackers would then turn and run back, leaving their wounded comrades to slow, agonizing deaths. The Japanese never asked for a truce to gather their fallen, as the Chinese snipers took shifts, bringing anyone down foolish enough to show themselves. Mercy and mutual respect had long since left this field of battle. Then the rains returned and filled up the trenches. Now rice and other foods had to be eaten without preparation. The Japanese soldiers became despondent in their hope for victory, or even just staying alive. Some faked illness to try to get sent to the rear, but most prepared themselves for death. Meanwhile, thousands of miles away, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt criticized Japan in a rather indirect way by saying in a speech in Chicago, "It would seem to be unfortunately true that the epidemic of world lawlessness is spreading He then, again, indirectly, compared Japan to a disease, and that the solution was to quarantine that disease to stop its spread. But Chiang Kai-shek, though delighted with such talk, was more practical. He told his various ambassadors to encourage other nations to ask for sanctions against Japan, to starve the resource-poor island nation into submission. And honestly, this was China's best bet, as the League in Brussels could agree on no particular course of action. Incredibly, on October 21st, as the Japanese thrust south had been halted, the Japanese Foreign Minister, Hirota Koki, spoke to the German ambassador in Tokyo, Herbert von Dirksen. He asked the foreigner if he was surprised that China had not sued for peace yet, or frankly, had somehow staved off a military defeat. The German diplomat wisely sidestepped the question and instead offered up his country to mediate. Tokyo took up this offer and created its list of demands. First and foremost, certain Chinese territory in the north had to come under long-term control of Japan. That's what everything to date was all about: resources. Next, the Chinese had to be willing to enlarge the demilitarized zone around Shanghai. If the Japanese could not get what they wanted there through sheer force, then they would settle for economic dominance. The German ambassador in Tokyo sent the document to Oscar Trautmann, Berlin's ambassador in Nanjing. He gave it to Chiang Kai-shek. The nationalist leader, upon reading it, kept his face closed. Instead, he asked the German what he thought of the conditions. The German was decent enough to be honest by stating that what was written on the document didn't matter. It was the beginning of a possible settlement to end the war. However, that Chiang should be careful. After all, Germany, near the end of the Great War, waited too long to seriously negotiate, and then found itself talking from a weakened military position. Better to talk now while the end result was still unknown. Yet Chiang did not believe his situation was the same as it had been for the Germans back then. He had millions of men to call upon and would use them, no matter how many died. In fact, other forces were at the moment being gathered south of Dachang, in case the latest defensive line there gave way. No, he would wait and see. Besides, he still had a relative ace up his sleeve, those four divisions from Guangxi. The attack by these four divisions would begin on October 21st, but in the evening, as the soon-coming darkness would take away the enemy's greatest asset, its air power. However, the fighting just south of Wusong Creek had been so intense that these troops, at first, had been thrown into the fray when they first arrived. But now it was time to pull them out so they could get into position. Of course, troop movement of this magnitude was noticed, and General Matsui quickly figured out what was about to happen. And he was happy with it. As he wrote in his diary, "It will give us an opportunity to catch the enemy outside of his prepared defenses and kill him there." His right flanks, north and south of Wusong Creek, were reinforced. When 7 o'clock came on October 21st, the Chinese guns opened up. This went on for an hour, and then the Guangxi divisions advanced eastward. Just north of Wusong Creek, those two divisions, led by the 176th Guangxi Division, hit the Japanese in their right flank. Their initial progress was better than expected, and all ran before them. However, the Chinese were soon slowed, not by the enemy, but by nature, as the creeks and canals ran every which way. These same obstacles had hindered the Japanese when they were on the offensive. Now the waterways were saving their lives. Still, the men of Guangxi surged forward. Then someone realized that if they moved too far, too fast. Then their supply train would not be able to reach them when they stopped. That meant no food, water, or ammunition. So it was decided locally that the two divisions would pull back, and the men ended up abandoning most of what they had captured by morning. They told themselves that when night came again, they would retake the same territory and end the enemy's attack south. As for the two divisions south of Wusan Creek, this group, led by the 174th Guangxi Division, had started out well enough. But then those same waterways hindered them. These, plus the determined and forewarned Japanese defenses, stymied any further advance. To their rear, the Chinese had enough bridge-building material to cross the canals to get to the Japanese lines, but somehow they were never brought forward. As the night of October 21st, 22nd went by, the Chinese troops worried what would happen to them when daylight came. Namely, the Japanese bombers would soon be overhead. With this pending doom in their collective thinking, the men backtracked to their starting points to better defend themselves against the coming air attacks. Again, these men, like their comrades north of the creek, told themselves that when night came, they would make up for their lack of progress, and this time remember to bring up the bridge supplies. During the night, both groups had lost many men to achieve their advances, only to give them away. When the sun arose on October 22nd, the Japanese took to the air with almost every available warplane they had. To the north of Wusan Creek, one of the 176th Division's battalions was surrounded by enemy ground troops. The Japanese then opened up with their artillery, and a few hours later, the entire battalion was wiped out. The only success the Chinese had that day was when another section was attacked by Japanese infantry, which was supported by 5 tanks. The defenders' lines almost broke, but at the last minute, other troops were rushed in for support. As for the tanks, 2 of the 5 quickly became stuck. This allowed the Chinese to focus on 1, which was destroyed. The 2 remaining retreated with the infantry. When night came on the 22nd, the Chinese again advanced. This time, they held on to most of what they had captured during the night. However, during their attack, the Japanese were also busy moving all available men and guns to the 2 right flanks. When dawn came, not only did every Japanese plane climb into the air to go hunting, but the Japanese infantry moved out, pushing west instead of south. The Japanese air power focused on the 174th Division south of the creek, as it was seen as the greater threat. The men of the 174th disappeared as bombs rained down on them that October 23rd. By the time the Japanese pulled back, the Chinese had lost some 2,000 men, including 2 brigade commanders, 6 regimental commanders, and many battalion and company commanders. The great Chinese counterattack was over. Chiang Kai-shek's German advisors tried to keep their faces passive, but amongst themselves, they had predicted this outcome. Little intelligence had been gathered beforehand. Not enough bridge-making materials was rounded up, or kept with the moving front. The men of Guangxi had little fighting experience, as did their officers. But worst of all, the Chinese had attacked where the enemy was strongest, near their front lines. Either way, the war over Shanghai was being lost by the defenders, and yet the Chinese could not leave the city, as the meeting in Brussels was about to get underway, which did not change the fact that the front was collapsing. Chiang therefore decided, for political reasons, to give up his positions to the north of the city. But that foreigners would continue to comment back home, he would have a detachment remain behind and harass the Japanese. In Jabe, located immediately north of the foreign settlements. That way, the Westerners would have a front row seat as his men were slaughtered, for there could be no other outcome. It was decided that the Chinese 1st Battalion of the 524th Regiment, just over 1,000 men, would remain behind and fortify the Four Banks Warehouse, just south of Wusong Creek and within sight of the foreigners, and make their last stand. It was their job to show that China was still in this fight and to make the Japanese pay heavily when they finally took the building. These men would be remembered as China's Lost Battalion. By October 23rd, the Chinese troops, up and down the line, were shaken by the lack of success of the Guangxi divisions. If four divisions could not shift the Japanese, then what chance did the latest defensive line at Dachang have? And Cheng must have agreed, as the troops were ordered to pull back. So that night of October 23rd, 24th, the defenders, those stationed between Wusong Creek and Dachang, hard upon the Xiao Mantong Creek, just 2 miles further south, began to pull back. Yet the Japanese sentries caught this and reported it back to Matsui. The general knew that, finally, his moment had come. The monumental losses he had sustained to get to this point were about to pay off. At 9 a.m. on October 24th, he ordered his divisional commanders to attack, to drive south as hard and as fast as they could. One way to defeat a larger force was to have it come at you while you were in a strong defensive position. The next best way was to catch the larger force on the run and never let them stop, all the while slaughtering them. Just hours into the morning of October 24th, not only did the Japanese, from left to right, the 9th and 3rd Divisions, push all the way to the Xiao Mengtang Creek, some units had been able to cross there. It seemed that soon, perhaps even before the day was out, the western approaches to Shanghai would be open. And yet General Matsui was not satisfied. After all of this still had to be considered only the opening moves to the battle for Shanghai.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Greetings, everyone, from Central Virginia. So just to let you know, I'm pretty sure I can get out one more episode before the end of the year. Then there'll be a short break. I spend time with the family, but I will be writing, so there'll be a little explosion of episodes coming out in January. I'm gonna keep Shanghai going and the war between Japan and China going, but I'm also mix it up with some other things. We're gonna take a look at British Bomber Command, what they've been trying to do. So we'll play with the timeline a little bit, but I'll make it clear what I'm doing. But we'll kind of get a couple storylines going just to keep it interesting, keep it fresh for you. If you have not filled out that survey for me, I mentioned a couple of episodes ago. If you could just take a minute to fill it out, that would really be great and helpful for me. And that will be in the episode notes as well, along with the one for the book. And you should definitely check that out. It looks like it's going to be really good. It's December 4th when this comes out. Still a little bit of time for Christmas. If you want to order coffee mugs from me, if you're in the United States, just go to the website. If you're anywhere else, just shoot me an email, wwiipodcast@gmail.com. Tell me where you're at. I have the FDR and the Churchill mugs. Just let me know where you live, and I can get you a quote pretty quick, and then you just let me know if you want it or not. That's I'll keep it nice and simple for you. So just think about the coffee mugs, or if you want to get membership for someone for a Christmas present, you can find all the information on the website as well. So again, one more episode before the end of the year. Thank you for everyone who listens and supports the show. I really do appreciate it, and I hope you all have a very safe and happy holiday.